This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
And yes, this is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, not surprisingly, given the recent American elections and all the other stuff, is David Smith, the Washington correspondent for The Guardian newspapers. And David is no stranger to listeners to this station. We call on him periodically to help make sense out of the roaring, screaming chaos that is the United States. And we like David because he understands our part of the world. He spent years in South Africa as the Guardian correspondent for this continent, and then moved to the United States, where he is busy trying to understand that very strange place. That very strange place has, in fact, just had an election, not the president, not the midterm election, but the off-year election. America has elections at the drop of a hat. I mean, that's one of the great sports in America. And up for grabs this year was the mayor's office in New York City, governorship in New Jersey, and the governorship in Virginia, Supreme Court justices in the state of Pennsylvania, three of them, and a referendum in California about whether or not they would go ahead with a redistricting of congressional seats to give Democrats maximum advantage in response to the way Texas and Florida are reconfiguring theirs to give Republicans an advantage. Lots to talk about. And David, thank you very much for joining. It's I know, an extremely busy time for you, and we welcome you here.
Great to be here. And just last month, I marked my 10th anniversary of departing South Africa and moving to the United States and settling in Washington. I've still sadly never been back to South Africa in that time, but I hope to one day. And an exciting night of elections here.
There are two ways to describe it. One is to take each of the elections piece by piece and figure out how that worked and why it happened the way it did. But there's the larger question of whether there are some discernible trends or through lines that can be explained. Maybe start with the trends and through lines and then break it down a little further.
Well, I think America gave Donald Trump a bloody nose. This was the first major election night since Trump came back to power. And in fact, I think today, Wednesday, is exactly 1 year since he beat Kamala Harris in the 2024 presidential election. We've had some smaller special elections during that year, and Democrats have done very well. But this was the first time you actually got the American people giving their verdict on Trump so far, even though, of course, he himself is not on the ballot. But we saw Democrats much motivated than Republicans turn out in these races. Again, some important caveats, the big three elections were New York City and Virginia and New Jersey. Trump has lost in those places in past elections. You know, he's not especially popular. So, you know, you would not expect his Republican Party to thrive there. But the reality was Democrats did extremely well. They not only won those elections, but they won them comfortably. Their candidates actually outpaced Kamala Harris in 2024. And that says something, I think, about Trump's lack of popularity right now. He's at an all-time low approval rating in his second term. People elected him to lower the cost of daily living, and that has not happened. People don't like him, you know, building a $300 million ballroom at the White House. What we've seen with tariffs, with immigration crackdowns, with the military in the streets, a whole bunch of issues. So I think that is one important trend and through line. And then, there will be debate over what all this says about the Democratic Party. Certainly, this was the night when Democrats got back in business for a while, to an extent. They were, you know, a boxer who'd been knocked out, sort of picking themselves up off the canvas. I think they'll be very relieved with these results, glad that they did so well. But yeah, we can talk about, break it down individually, as you say, beyond that.
One of the things that seemed to be indicated, at least in the press that I was reading and the broadcast I was watching, and the friends who were sending me comments along the way, there's a presumption that this represents, this set of elections represents a new generation of politicians, although of course the people who won the governorships in Virginia and New Jersey were already politicians. They'd already been elected to offices previously, although one had been a military officer, one had been an intelligence officer in their previous lives. They had seen something of the world and they had political experience. And in New York City, the mayor-elect had a short career as a state legislator, but he animated a crowd in a way which, I think it was you who mentioned it to me, Pete, you hadn't seen since Barack Obama spoke to audiences. But there is the old adage, of course, in politics, campaigning is like chanting poetry and governing is like reading the tax code. It's one thing to win an election. It's another thing to then get a hold of the levers of power and make use of them in ways which comport in some way with their campaign. And other people, other interests, other politicians, reality gets in the way far too often. But it also seems to me that although Mamdani was one version of politics, certainly more left than most Democrats would appear to be, the two candidates who are governors-elect now are clearly centrists, and they ran on kitchen table issues. But all three of them were kitchen tableists, table issues-oriented politicians in a curious way. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. Important to note, you know, New York, the biggest city in the U.S., tremendously diverse, not necessarily the best test case for what's going to work in the rest of the country. You know, New York is pretty unique. It's quite an outlier in many respects. So it's hard to read off from there what's going to work elsewhere. Certainly, Zohra Mamdani, this tremendously successful campaign, really electrifying young progressives. He's going to be the first Muslim mayor of that city. He's only 34 years old. He's a proud democratic socialist. It was, and I think, you know, he really succeeded partly through old-fashioned, you know, shoe leather campaigning, walking the streets, talking to people, partly through his social media skills, humorous viral videos that he made, and partly because of his policies. Yeah, he did talk relentlessly about the affordability crisis in New York, just the sheer cost of living, of trying to, you know, afford housing there, and so on. And he has plans for, you know, free buses and freezing subsidized rental apartments and city-run grocery stores, and all of that seemed to strike a chord. But then, as you say, before progressives get carried away and argue, okay, we've cracked it, this is the future of the Democratic Party, let's go left, let's embrace Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and this left-wing agenda, you know, what happened in New Jersey and Virginia did look somewhat different. And last week I spent some time on the campaign trail with Abigail Spanberger in Alexandria and in Norfolk, where Her campaign rally, the star attraction was Barack Obama, obviously another figure from the Democrats' past. And yes, she is really a moderate, a centrist. I think when she was in Congress, she and Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey were described as the mod squad as opposed to the progressive squad. Really talking about their national security credentials, CIA, Navy pilot, and so on. Notably, at the events I went to, Spanberger, I think, never mentioned Trump by name. She was trying to get away from that approach of we have to rescue democracy from Donald Trump and isn't Trump terrible? Instead, she focused more on the consequences of Trump's policies on the economy and so on. And yes, I think you're right that even though these are ideologically diverse figures in some ways, they seem to be from different wings of the party. What does unite Democrats right now, along with a commitment to democracy, along with the opposition to Trump, is this focus on kitchen table issues, this realization that the gap between the rich and the poor is growing, that the lower middle class, the working class are really suffering. People are working three jobs. They struggle to make ends meet. They struggle to put food on the table. That's a message that all of them can get around, even if they have different approaches. And Donald Trump is making it easier for them because right now he's throwing Great Gatsby-themed Halloween parties at Mar-a-Lago. He's kind of flaunting his wealth and power. There's a very sort of stark split screen there.
We're going to take a short ad break. We're speaking with David Smith, the Guardian correspondent in Washington. We're trying to sum up in a very preliminary kind of way the impact of the American election that happened on Tuesday. We'll be right back after these messages. This is The Deep Dive.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooks Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, I'm delighted to have David Smith, a Guardian correspondent in Washington. And we're trying to parse out, at least in this preliminary moment, what happened in the American election that took place on Tuesday in New York and New Jersey, in Virginia, California, and a few other places for various offices. David, does this black eye or slight punch to the gut to Donald Trump, or slight smack in the chops, does this mean that he will be a chastened figure? He will pull back from some of the stranger versions of Donald Trumpism, or will he redouble his efforts to prove that he is still the one, the invincible Donald Trump? How is this going to play out, do you think? You've been watching him for years. You may have a better insight to it than most.
Just very quickly, picking up on the last point, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democrat, was asked, you know, so who is the face of the Democratic Party now? Is it Zohran Mamdani or is it Abigail Spanberger? And she replied, I think, fairly accurately, you know, it's both of those. It's, you know, the party has many faces in the same way the country has many faces. And in a state like Virginia, you probably want Spanberger. In a city like New York, you want Mamdani. And, you know, that's the way politics works. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see if Democrats pursue that model going forward. As for Trump, I mean, I think there's already some signals coming from the White House along the lines of, hey, you know, Kamala Harris won New Jersey and Virginia and New York City in 2024. So nothing changes. You know, we kind of knew that these are more Democratic strongholds. I suspect, you know, we might get a petulant message from Trump, maybe about the way the election was run, or, you know, even alleging fraud, knowing him. I think he will probably shrug it off. It certainly begs the question, you know, how will he approach the midterm elections a year from now, which, you know, if the results of tonight were replicated, could seriously curtail Trump's power for the rest of his term. But yeah, knowing him, he will not at all be chastened, or, you know, he will not do what a normal president would do, which is think to himself, you know, maybe I'm on the wrong course here. Maybe I should listen to what the people say. He will find others to blame, perhaps Democratic, perhaps the Republican candidates, perhaps the government shutdown. And the great fear among some observers is, when they see results like this, Trump and the Republicans will respond by finding ways to game the system in their favor, voting restrictions or sending troops into polling stations, or, you know, try and prevent the 2026 midterms from being free and fair.
Let me shift the focus just a bit. While the elections were taking, the campaigns and then the elections were taking place, there were a couple of international related events that the Trump administration seems to have undertaken. One, of course, is an effort to move a Navy flotilla just off the coast of Venezuela in an effort to do something. I'm not entirely quite clear on what the something really, really is. And then there was the, by my lights, the rather bizarre decision to threaten Nigeria that if the government doesn't stop the genocide against Christians, quote unquote, that they would have to send in the army and do something to stop that. Where do these things come from, and how do they suddenly come forward like a class five hurricane, and then we stop seeing them? What's the dynamic for this, and where do these things go?
And I've heard, for example, John Bolton, former national security advisor to Trump, you know, describe it as literally little blurts, little things popping in his brain almost sort of randomly, with no rhyme or reason. The usual answer for why Donald Trump is approaching talking about a particular subject is that he has seen it on TV, which sounds sort of too trite and bizarre to be real, but you know, he consumes great amounts of TV. Often in his rhetoric, he'll reflect something that was on Fox News a few hours ago, and politicians and others have learned, if you want to get Trump's attention, maybe go on TV and talk about it, or get this item to be shown on a screen. How and why he picked up this issue in Nigeria, who knows? And maybe somebody on TV was talking about that. Maybe somebody else brought it to his attention. I suspect it. When that happens, it takes the foreign policy establishment in Washington by surprise, and they have to scramble. And they hope that Trump will quickly forget it and move on again. The Venezuela case has been dragging on for longer. I mean, we've got this issue now of the U.S. military carrying out strikes on people on boats who are alleged to be smuggling drugs, these kind of narco traffickers. This has happened several times under Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Democrats are demanding more information. Human rights advocates, even some Republicans, question, you know, how can you carry out what are effectively extrajudicial killings? We don't know who's on these boats. No idea whether they're actually guilty of these crimes. And yes, some suspect that ultimately Trump's goal is regime change in Venezuela, overthrowing President Maduro, which feels a sort of strange throwback to American foreign policy of the 1980s and meddling in Latin America. And such a move would be tremendously divisive, you know, as would some kind of intervention in Nigeria, in that, again, Trump's whole campaign promise was America first, isolationism, staying out of foreign conflicts, not getting entangled. And yet there are moments like this when he seems to be channeling more former Vice President Dick Cheney, who just died on Tuesday, with that more aggressive interventionist stance. And of course, we all know what happened to Dick Cheney and George W. Bush in Iraq.
Two things have occurred to me as you were talking. One, of course, in the case of Nigeria, there actually was, and I'm doing a review of this story for something I may write, there actually was a U.S. intervention along the coast of what became Nigeria back in the 1840s and 50s, an anti-slavery naval patrol in conjunction with the British fleet that captured ships that surreptitiously were trying to break what was then, in effect, international law about the smuggling of people who would become slaves into the American South and Latin America and Cuba. I know Donald Trump hasn't read that history, but you know, you're laughing. I can see that. But it has that strange echo for me. In the case of Maduro, I just wonder, you know, every time you have one of these interventions, as you point to the Iraq war, things don't go quite according to plan. And what this means to me, taken together, is there anybody in the White House now who actually can say, Mr. President, you know, whatever you're saying, that's interesting, but it's harder to do some of these things than you think, or that the commentator on Fox News on the weekend seems to believe is possible? Are there no rays of reality that poke through this cloud?
You know, I was just reading a few hours ago an article about Trump's meeting with President Xi of China last week, where there was, I'm a little vague on the details from memory, but the main issue was the idea of the US company Nvidia selling AI chips to China, and apparently, almost universally, Trump's entire cabinet, his advisors, all the people around him at the White House said, "Mr. President, this would be a really bad idea. It'd be just a security risk giving China that access." And it appears he did listen, and he did not bring up this possibility, the potential carrot, in his meeting with Xi. So maybe there's at least one data point where, he's taking the advice of some of these people some of the time. I have to think that if he was genuinely talking about, we are going to send an invasion force to Venezuela or Nigeria or both, there would be some people, such as Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who would introduce at least some notes of sanity and reason, and let's talk about this. But that said, Trump has concentrated and expanded presidential power. Sometimes, he's issuing statements on social media. I think before any of these advisors and cabinet secretaries even know about it, they have to play catch up. That kind of unilateral action is already very dangerous domestically. It could be even more dangerous internationally in a foreign policy crisis. And yes, I think America has that very checkered record already of these foreign interventions. The idea of Trump being the man behind it is perhaps even more alarming.
David, we're going to take another quick ad break. We're speaking with David Smith, the Washington correspondent for The Guardian, and our muse who gives us the inside sense of what is and is not true about the United States in Washington, and we call on him routinely for this. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, of course, David Smith, Guardian correspondent in Washington. And we're contemplating the effect, the implications of the recent elections in the United States, excuse me, and the broader picture. And you were talking about China briefly, the meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping. South Africa is now becoming aware of the fact that the G20 meeting is about to break on this country in a couple of weeks. Dozens of international leaders will show up, hundreds of aides will show up, thousands of hangers-on will show up, vast multitudes of other people who want to be on the inside will be here. One of the people who will not be here is Donald Trump. J.D. Vance, the vice president, will be here. And this seems to be a kind of a denigration of the impact or the importance of an international gathering like the G20. Which in other circumstances you might think of as prime audience moment for Donald Trump to give his version of the world and its future. What do you make of this?
Well, I think of how Trump has always been skeptical about multilateral organizations and over the years criticized NATO. Although he would argue he's actually strengthened it by forcing NATO members to pay up more. He did show up at the UN, of course, a few months ago, but lambasted that organization for its failures. Yeah, I think just something like the G20 is probably not on his radar very much. And, now if its members were offering him the Nobel Peace Prize, that would be different. But yeah, he is not not really a fan of these international groupings, and we've seen that very starkly, of course, on the whole issue of the climate crisis, where he pulled out of the Paris Agreement and is also snubbing those get-togethers. All of that said, I think it's interesting to see J.D. Vance there. Early in the term, he went to Europe and shocked people with a speech that was really critical of Europe's policies on immigration and freedom of speech. He kind of chastise the hosts there. It'll be fascinating to see if and when he gives a speech, what does he say to the G20 about itself, and what does he show of his worldview, and does he see to use it as a platform for his own presidential ambitions? Is there that sense of him being the heir apparent? And when you listen to him, you're listening to Trump's voice. I think nothing can quite match the charisma and craziness of Trump at these events, but actually, JD Vance will be sort of fascinating to watch in his own way.
David, I assume you did not go to the Great Gatsby party in Florida with Donald Trump. I really, really wanted someone to tell me what the party was like, and did it really have a flavor of the Great Gatsby to it? It looked, from the pictures I saw, as if it was a live version of either of the two films that had been done on the novel. But let's talk about the succession plan. Donald Trump will not be president after the year 2028, or at least he won't be in office. How are they going to figure out who's going to take on his mantle, who's going to be in charge, who is going to be the future Donald Trump version 2.0?
These are all great questions, and yes, just to get it out of the way, Trump continues to tease the idea that he could somehow break from the Constitution and serve a third term, even to the extent that when he had Democrats in the Oval Office negotiating over the government shutdown, which, by the way, is now on about 35 days, which is beating the all-time record, he actually had hats that said Trump 2028. On view, and when world leaders come to the White House, he shows them these hats that say Trump 2028. And if you go to rallies, those are on sale. And sometimes he makes remarks saying, maybe there's a way. And other times he says, oh no, I guess I can't do it. A lot of that may just be a tease just to, sort of drive his opponents crazy. But his advisor, Steve Bannon, is still insistent that Trump will serve a third term. But anyway, let's assume that's not going to happen. The other thing that Trump says of note is that J.D. Vance, the vice president, and Marco Rubio, the secretary of state, are both strong contenders to succeed him. I think he hinted at one point, what if they could get together? I guess the notion there, perhaps Vance as the candidate with Rubio as his running mate. Beyond that, I doubt there is much of a structured plan so far. I think Trump may fall into that trap of so many other chief executives and politicians and others, even football managers who have a long reign, and then the one thing they forget is the succession plan. But as things stand, per the normal political calendar, after tonight's elections, we're going into the midterms. Even before then, the drumbeat will start of who are the likely nominees, the likely candidates for a Republican primary election. We'll have the Iowa State Fair. We'll have speeches. We'll head into the actual Iowa caucuses, New Hampshire primary, and so on. In theory, anybody can run, and it's going to be fascinating to see if it is Vance and others. Do they copy Trump? Do they try to be Trump 2.0? Do they try to be a mini Trump? Or do they do something else? And I actually went to a JD Vance event a few weeks ago where I thought it was interesting. He obviously had some Trumpian themes and policies, but he was also doing his own thing and trying to separate himself. And he was actually quite skilled at it, the way he took a child out of the crowd and took a photo with him, and the way people were interacting, remembering Vance's mother, and the way he took some questions from reporters at the end. He's quite sort of polished at this. One thing quite a lot of the people there kept saying was, we like JD because he's one of us. They think his upbringing in fairly humble beginnings, makes him a man of the people in some ways. And I think he and others would be wise to maybe be Trump adjacent, but not try to copy Trump too directly, because, as we saw yet again in the latest election results in the US, it's very hard for anyone to just be a direct Trump clone. Who wants the tribute band when, the real thing is still playing?
I hesitate to ask this because I know, although you've lived in America for a decade, probably in your heart of hearts, you're still a fan of some football club in Britain in that inscrutable game that is played there, soccer, football, or some such. But the World Series, which doesn't take place throughout the world, but which had a significant international texture to it this year between Los Angeles Dodgers and the Toronto Blue Jays, the Toronto Blue Jays, of course, are based in Toronto, which is not in America, but which is in Canada. And the Los Angeles Dodgers, some of their biggest stars are in fact Japanese. Who were you rooting for? And did you watch the games? Because it was, from what I could see of it, at the ridiculous hour I had to get up to watch, it was an extraordinary sporting event.
Yeah, it was epic, and I will say I'm not a huge baseball fan. I don't have time to watch much of it normally. I've been to a few games of the Washington Nationals here, but yeah, even I was sucked into this because it was clearly a sporting epic, and you can always appreciate that whether you're a diehard fan or not. I guess I was lucky. I wasn't especially rooting for one team or the other. I mean, I like Los Angeles as a place, so I had nothing against them. I was aware, however, that the Blue Jays were somewhat more of the underdogs, and also, as ever these days, there's always some politics involved. There was that backdrop of Trump has been picking on Canada, so I think not only Canadians were rooting for the Blue Jays. There were actually some people in the U.S. who were rooting for the Canadian team. Because of that Trump situation, and certainly I know anecdotally I know Canadians who live both in Britain and South Africa who are watching from afar who said they felt genuine grief at the result, the way it was cruelly snatched away from the Blue Jays. But yeah, a great series, clearly.
I must tell you, I'm a diehard Philadelphia Phillies fan, and every time I hear the name Toronto Blue Jays, it gives me a pain, a deep existential pain. They beat the Phillies in a World Series competition in 1993.
The last time the Blue Jays won it, yeah.
Yeah, on a walk-off home run by Joe Carter, and it hurts me existentially every time I see the name Toronto, let alone watch them. I didn't root for the Dodgers either, although I was really enamored with their Japanese contingent
Sure, yeah.
because of the skill, that the combativeness and the never give up moments. But one last thing before we go, American politicians and lots of analysts and certainly some journalists are almost fixated when they think internationally on two things. One is the challenge of China in economic terms that could translate into security terms. And the other is the seemingly never-ending tragedy of the Middle East. And as an observer of American politics, do these things loom as large in the people you encounter, as I think they do, or are they even more important, perhaps?
China and the Middle East.
You got about 4 words for that if you
I
want.
mean, I'd say, I mean, yes and no. In that, the world I occupy here in Washington, foreign policy is big, and of course, those issues are there. And I'd say, Israel in particular, there is no issue more divisive and incendiary. And it was there again in the New York mayoral race, and it's been on university campuses, and it really touches a nerve. But on the other hand, I think America is often quite an insular country, and if you watch TV news and the media, there's often not a lot of international coverage. I'd say very little of Africa, especially, but even those other places, and especially China does not get that much attention. And we've all seen those statistics about how many Americans have passports or not. So there are millions of people who are thinking about the World Series and baseball and American football and other things rather than China and Israel and issues like that. Like this debate of the future of the Democratic Party, it's very varied. I'd say, yeah, to your question, some people yes and some people no.
Yeah, no, I assume that, and I realize that my news diet, my information diet skews a little bit more toward paying attention to those things than certainly the average person, even the average analyst, by virtue of where I am and my own interests. But is there, I mean, take this one step further, is there a sense that America is in decline, or is America on the ascent again, or is the jury out so deeply that it's not clear one way or the other for most people?
I'm afraid the latest opinion polls show that a majority of Americans think that the country is going in the wrong direction. They would, critics of Trump would blame him. Others would just look at the years of gridlock in Washington, the deepening political polarization, the eruptions of political violence we've had, of course, the killing of Charlie Kirk, among other things, and this cost of living crisis, just the bite of growing inequality and the difficulty for people to make ends meet. And of course, there's a paradox there because by some other measures, America is more powerful than it's ever been. The stock market is soaring again, largely thanks to artificial intelligence. Compared to the rest of the world, America is still a very happy place to be with a lot of consumer choice, a lot of wealth, a lot of offerings. But I think the nation's politics, arguably in recent decades, has gone from aspiration to anxiety, and that has been manifested in all sorts of ways, including the rise of a demagogue such as Donald Trump.
You fill me with such joy. Oh dear. And here I was going to ask you about your football team.
Well, let's not do that because that's Wolverhampton Wanderers, and they are rock bottom of the Premier League. I think pretty much the worst start to season in the club's 140 odd year history, and they just literally sacked their manager last weekend. So you are touching a sore point there.
They're well on their way to relegation to some very, very low level where they take volunteers from the stands in order to man the team. Oh dear. Let's wind up on a happier note. Taylor Swift is engaged now. Is she still as popular as she was 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
I think so. I mean, her latest album got some critical reviews from the music critics, but actually, I think it was as big a hit as ever, and she had sort of several of the top 10 on Spotify and so on. And she is still a phenomenon. Her engagement, I guess the upcoming wedding will be the wedding of the century, with kind of huge coverage. And obviously a husband to be a professional American football player. Again, in some ways, it's nice respite from the political churn. In others, of course, Trump sometimes has a go at her. Nothing can quite escape. But the Taylor Swift phenomenon continues to expand.
We're going to take one last ad break, and this is the Deep Dive with David Smith, the Washington correspondent for The Guardian, is our guest. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. We'll be right back after these messages to wrap up and to move on with the rest of the day.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, David Smith of The Guardian newspapers, Washington correspondent for them. We've covered the landscape. We've covered lots and lots of things. One last question, just, you know, give us a minute or two of your thoughts on this. What are the key things that we should be watching for over the next number of months and perhaps into next year? What are the big things that we should pay attention to?
Yeah, it's always so hard to say with Trump, isn't it? Because he just keeps surprising us. And we, you know, today, for example, we haven't even really talked about this saga of Trump suddenly deciding to demolish the East Wing of the White House out of nowhere, which really was a visceral blow to some people and a metaphor right on the nose in terms of Trump being a wrecking ball for democracy. And we talk about Venezuela, Nigeria. I think sometimes with Trump, that is the point. Just keep us all guessing, keep flooding the zone, keep bombarding us with new dramas and new events. But now we have these latest elections out of the way. I think very quickly it's going to be all about the midterms. Will Republicans retain the House of Representatives and Senate? And, you know, if they don't, what does that mean for Trump? First, before any of that, we have to get this government shut down out of the way. For example, got 42 million people facing the loss of food aid, huge debates over healthcare and so on. Will the peace in Gaza hold? Will Trump finally solve the war in Ukraine as he's promised? These are all lingering questions, but just to bring us back to something we touched on earlier, you know, with every passing day, we do get nearer the end of the Trump presidency and this question of succession. And yes, we might have J.D. Vance and others stepping forward, but can Trump himself kind of mentally cope with that idea of ceding the limelight of someone else taking over? You know, would he endorse them? Would he campaign for them? Or would he become, you know, bitter and twisted at the idea of someone else stealing his thunder?
Sort of like King Lear.
Yes.
I mean, somebody's bound to write it that way soon enough.
I think I've used the King Lear analogy more than once already over the years.
Oh, okay. David, it's been a delight to speak with you again. I hope we can do this in the future in a couple of months when there are new crises and disasters to speak about. Let me just again say thanks so much for joining us. David Smith, the Washington correspondent for The Guardian newspapers, a veteran of years in Africa, where we got to know him, now well and truly ensconced in Washington after a decade there. And I always enjoy his insights and his sort of wry humor and bemusement at the way in which Americans comport themselves when confronted with disaster or opportunity. And again, thanks very much for joining us. To my audience, this program is rebroadcast on Sundays at 10 o'clock. And if you have friends who didn't hear it, you don't see radio, do you, who didn't hear it, please tell them they can listen in on Sunday morning. Otherwise, it's podcast available. And you all have a good weekend and be safe. And we'll be back next week with another guest.